Did you know that over 1 million new businesses launch each year, yet nearly 40% fail in their first year and 80% within five? I'm Derek Schmidt, and I don't want you to become another statistic. That's why I started the Entrepreneur Bootcamp podcast. I'm going to use real-world experience and straightforward advice to help you navigate through the rough waters of entrepreneurship. Whether you're drafting your first business plan or aiming for new heights, this is your toolkit for however you define success. Let's dive in. All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Entrepreneur Bootcamp Podcast. My name is Derek Schmidt. Our mission at the Entrepreneur Bootcamp Podcast is to help people as they're starting and growing businesses to create their definition of success. Today, I'm grateful to have our guest, Regina Fisher, with the Bristol Group. Regina, welcome. Can you start by telling us a little bit about the Bristol Group and what you do?
All right. Thanks for having me, Derek. Great pleasure. Bristol Group is a boutique business brokerage. That means we focus on helping business owners of privately held businesses when they're looking to exit, sell their business. We are a nationwide group. We're scattered across the country, but we work very independently. So it's not like a franchise. Each broker has their own background, their own focus, specific industries. But we share resources with each other's cheerleader and mentor. And if I come across a situation that I've never seen, I have a team behind me that I can reach out to and talk to them. But other than that, when I deal with my clients, I'm the person that they deal with. And I service them from start to finish here in primarily in this area.
Well, that's great. Great to hear. How long have you been doing this?
Here in Wilmington since 2018. That's when I joined the Bristol Group. My background is I prior worked in the fintech industry and strategic partnerships globally. So I like to compare that. I used to work on really big deals globally in a very niche, and now I'm working on medium-sized to small deals, but industry agnostic, here in the United States.
What made you want to get into this?
Oh, it's fantastic. It's so exciting. I don't even know where to start, right? So I've always been very interested in M&A because it's just a very important step in any kind of business, whether it's privately owned or if it's a large organization with lots of shareholders, to make that move from this is our organizational structure, this is our identity, this is our culture. Now we either have a complete new owner that comes up with new ideas or mergers are super interesting too. So post-merger integration has always been a topic I've been fascinated about for over 20 years. Since I've been doing this here with the Bristol Group, it's just so rewarding to help a business owner through a very, very important phase of their life. A lot of times these people started a business 30 years ago, or their kids grew up in the business. They've gone through all these different crises. So, I don't know, the wife worked with them or the husband passed away. All kinds of really, it's been their life. It's been with them for a very long stretch of their life. And now to make that decision, I'm going to sell it. I'm going to hand over the reins to somebody else. And even if it's not 30 years, I recently sold a business. The guy has just started it in 2019, right? Yeah. He built it up. He was very proud of what he had. He had a really nice little thing going there, great team in place, great processes. And he was ready to move on because of personal situations. But then the last week before closing, he totally freaked out. He was so nervous. He just kept calling me. I mean, he was like in his 50s, right?
Yeah.
But he kept calling me and said, Regina, I have like all kinds of blotches in my face. I don't even know what I'm doing. I'm so concerned because it's this letting go of something that's been part of your daily life, right?
Yeah.
And that's probably very important to also understand. Owning a business is your life.
Yes.
It's very, very different from having a job.
I can imagine. I mean, I fantasize sometimes about like, what would it be like if I sold the company and what would I do and like stepping out? But then I'm like, man, it's so ingrained. And I love what I do. Like, I don't even consider it work. So then there's that side of it. And I can't imagine the stress. I can't imagine what I would do if I did try to sell my business.
Boy, you would have to talk to somebody like me.
Yeah, please. That's where it would start, right?
I'm sorry, I'm jumping on this one.
Sure.
But that's a very key part of what we do is, like you just said, this would be a big step for you and this would be the first time you're doing this. Yep. We do this all the time. Yep. Right? I sell businesses all day long for years. I'm not doing anything else. It's not like I'm selling a business every day, but I'm dealing with the business owners, I'm dealing with the buyers. I sell several businesses in a year. That's all I do. So every situation that you could not even imagine is going to pop up during that process, I've been there. Yeah. I've done it, right?
Yeah. Do you serve as like a therapist? Like for somebody who's like, what am I going to do afterwards? Like,
I should probably get a psychology degree just on the side.
Yeah.
But it is a lot of listening, a lot of understanding. I had a deal one time where two partners sold business together and the minority shareholder was just losing it completely. His whole life was falling apart at the same time.
Oh, wow.
And I had him for hours on the phone and he was just really stressed about the whole process.
Yeah.
And yeah, but that's part of the deal. And it's part of what I enjoy.
Yeah, I do. It's hard though. I mean, when I think of a business like a child or like a person that you have to like grow and foster and like build this personality around. So like being a father, I often associated with a child. It's hard to say goodbye to this child, you know, that he just spent so much time growing.
Yeah, 100%. So I just sent both of my kids off to college. I think selling the business is even harder.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that doesn't give me a lot of hope.
All right.
What is it that makes a business valuable for buyers?
All right. You got to look at it from the perspective of the buyer. Why would they want to buy this? What's their alternative? So the benefit of buying a business over starting from scratch is that you're stepping into a well-oiled machine. Mm-hmm. Now, how well-oiled is that machine? Right? That's the first question.
Yeah.
Systems, processes. A buyer buys a business because from day number one, the phone will keep ringing, the clients will knock on the door, the money will come in, the employees are coming to work, right? Mm-hmm. So that's that well-oiled machine. But very importantly is the seller has had a certain track record of success. And now the buyer wants to be sure that they're going to continue to be at least as successful as that seller was. Now, in that sale process, as we market the business for sale, how do we show a buyer that there is a track record, right? How do we show a buyer that things are going to continue to go smooth after they take over and they're going to be okay, right? Mm-hmm. So that's why we always look at the last 3 years of profit and loss, tax returns, and look where were those numbers. Are they going up? Are they going down? Are they fluctuating? Sometimes seasonality is also a topic, but where are these yearly numbers, right? And then how many employees do you have? What's the tenure of these employees? Are you constantly hiring new people? And then where do the customers come from? Are the customers personal buddies of the owner? Of course, yeah. Would be terrible. That's, I have a reason. Yeah, sure. Yeah. But you think that way. But even if the owner plays a specific role in the business, it's very hard to replace. Right? Is he the person who holds all the licenses required to run the business? That would make it more complicated. And how that all plays into that final sale process is obviously the more buyers we have in the market, the easier it will be to negotiate a good price. So all these different aspects are going to reduce our buyer pool. Like for instance, if I need that license, I'm only going to be able to attract people that have that license or have a way of getting that license, right? Yeah. So yeah, there we go from this to that.
Yeah.
If the track record of the business is very volatile, I'm going to have to find somebody who understands the business model really well and can trust that when it goes down, it will come back up again. And we have to have an explanation of what's behind there. If I don't have a long tenure with my employees, the buyer has to really trust that they're going to be able to always find new people, things like this. It's all about how can the buyer have that confidence. The more, if it's great track record, 10% increase in net profit every year, long tenure people with management in place, great systems and processes, marketing channels out there that constantly fill my pipeline mm-hmm. of customers. Oh, that's golden,
yeah. Right?
But nothing is ever perfect. And then the owner is semi-absentee, and he stops by and drops the checks and picks up the check. Oh, that's gold.
Yeah.
And how the...
But you want to sell that.
Yeah. And I probably should go a little bit into the net profit. A lot of people come to me, but I'm making $3 million in sales, right? Well...
I was going to ask that. What's more important, the revenue or the profit, the net profit?
What do you think?
I think it's the net profit.
Yeah, why?
Because I can have a million-dollar business, but if I have a small net profit, I'm really not a profitable business. I'm really not taking home, and as the owner, I'm collecting distributions. Depending on how legally I'm set up, I'm collecting distributions from that profit. And maybe even having a profit share in pool. Am I right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah. Because at the end of the day, everybody, whether it's the seller or the buyer, is interested in that business because of the money you can make with it. I mean, unless you're non-profit, but we're not talking non-profit in turn. So the net profit, the bottom line number, is the most important one. And I always say, like, look, you have two businesses that both make $1 million in sales, and this guy has 15 tractors and cranes and 20 employees and $30,000 worth of insurance and whatnot, and walks away with $20,000 in his pocket, and this guy sits with a laptop and a paperclip and a Post-it, and two employees that also have a laptop and a Post-it, and he walks away with $850,000. They guess this guy's going to get more money for his business. Very easily understood. So what's the key number we're looking for when we talk about business valuations? It is the seller's discretionary earning. So that is all the financial benefit coming towards the owner, coming from the business. EBITDA, earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, amortization, is the first number we calculate. So we look at the tax return and we add back expenses for depreciation, amortization, taxes, but not payroll taxes and not your franchise tax. It would have been your corporate income tax if you paid deducted that. That's what we add back. And then any kind of interest payments. The first three, because they're not really an expense, depreciation is not, you didn't really spend that $15,000 that you depreciated this year. Mm-hmm. So that's why we added back. Amortization, the same thing. Interest we add back because it is discretionary. If you have a loan and you have to pay interest, then you have that expense. But if you don't have that loan, you're not going to have that expense. It's discretionary the way that business owner runs their business. That's why we can add it back. And then, of course, income taxes, because it depends on the whole structure. So we have to make it comparable. So EBITDA number is the first one we calculate. And then we add back anything that's in the business expenses deducted that actually went to the owner. So did the owner get a salary or 1099, W-2 that's expensed in the business? Then we add that back. Did the business pay the owner's life insurance, owner's health insurance, owner's car that he uses privately, paid the wife a salary, but she is not involved in the business at all, as the cousins, I don't know, pays the cousin's car payment or something. Yes. There's all kinds of variations, right? And of course, the way I like to describe it is, it's a CPA's job to tuck the money in all the nooks and crannies, and then it's my job to just pick it back up.
Yeah.
But we don't want to get too much into the weeds of cents and dollars. We're looking at the large chunks. So that bottom, and it remind me to come back to that. At that bottom number, the seller's discretionary earning, that is the key number. Why? Because that's how we can make businesses comparable. So a buyer can say, well, if I buy that plumbing business, I'm going to walk away with $250,000 discretionary earning, although they show on paper only $40,000 in net profit because they had a lot of depreciation and that seller took out a large salary. But if I buy this landscaping business, I'm going to walk away with $180,000, although they showed $110,000 on their net profit, right?
Yeah.
So that's why we make that number comparable. It's like, this is your discretionary income. What do you want to pay yourself a salary? You want to pay that car? Or you want to hire somebody, that's the money you have available to play with as a buyer. And then one key thing that you need to keep in mind is, as a business owner, that bottom line number is that one that goes into your pocket and you walk home with that. But a buyer has that money and now they got to satisfy the loan they took out to buy the business. And what's left over has to satisfy their lifestyle.
Yeah.
And yes, 99.9% businesses are being bought with a loan. Most of the times an SBA loan. Very, very rare until we have cash buyers.
Okay.
Right? So that's where it all comes down. So now we have the discretionary income. We can compare different businesses. And now what is the value? The value is a multiple of that discretionary income.
Okay.
So when we do a business valuation, we do all these calculations. We look at the last 3 years. We don't go back further because it's irrelevant. Whether you were super, super successful 5 years ago or down the drain 5 years ago, the last 2 years are looking duck, that's what we're looking at.
Cool.
I always like to compare it with a beauty queen. If you were a beauty queen in high school, but in the meantime, you didn't take care of your body. You might not get that job at what anabolic age you. Okay, good. So the last 3 years are the key numbers. And right now we would be looking at 21, 22, 23 tax returns, and then this ongoing year profit and loss, and we compared how it's going so far. Okay. So now, what is that multiple? When we do a business valuation, we look at three different angles. The first one is we look at market comparables. What does the market tell us about comparable businesses? What was that X multiplier that they sold for? Mm-hmm. To give us an indication. For most small businesses that are somehow owners involved, those multipliers are somewhere in the 2 to 3 range. Sometimes it's a little bit less, sometimes it's a little bit more, but somewhere in just 2 to 3. So let's say you have $250,000 discretionary income. 2 to 3 would be somewhere between $500,000 and $750,000 is your value. Well, that's a big range.
Yeah.
So then now we dig deeper into that, right? And those are the different aspects. So the second viewpoint we're taking in the valuation is we look at the value drivers in the business. What makes this business attractive? So what's the owner's role? What's the competition situation? Where do the clients come from? What's the environment for this? How is this a growing business? And so forth. There's about 10, 15 different value drivers that we look at. And then we do a calculation and we come up with a weighted number again that gives us that same kind of multiplier. And then the third viewpoint we're taking, which is very important, we look at it from a buyer's perspective. So again, buyer goes to the bank, put some money down, gets a loan, depending on current interest rates, which is still pretty high, expected return on investment, what can the buyer even afford to pay for it, right?
Yeah.
Again, so if you buy a business where you make $250,000 a year, you can't pay that much money for it that your loan servicing will be a $300,000 note a year.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's not going to work, right? So we look at it from a buyer's perspective. And then with these three numbers, market, the value drivers, and then the buyer's perspective, we have a very good viewpoint of what this business can sell for. If they are very close to each other, we go, solid business. The market tells us a number, the business tells us a number, and the buyer tells us a number. They're all very similar.
Yeah.
If they're all over the place, we go, all right, well, something's wrong. Yeah. When the buyer is willing to pay X, but the market usually only gives you Y or something, or the other way around. Right? So that's why we do these three different angles.
It's interesting. I follow a guy, Jason Swank, who was specific to the agency space, sold his agency, and then was more of like a coach or a mentor to other agencies. And he always said, I believe he said, the multiple for an agency, when you do it, when you set it up correctly, run it correctly, is like 4 to 6x on EBITDA.
Yeah.
Which was like fascinating to me. So that's accurate.
So again,
well, that's one of the pillars.
Yeah, that's EBITDA. EBITDA is after the owner or manager gets paid a salary. So it would be a smaller number.
Okay.
Right? So that's the first thing you've got to watch out if you compare apples or cherries.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then depending, the key factor, which good that you brought that up, the key factor is obviously, where do my customers come from? I talked earlier about the buyer's confidence in continuing the track record.
Mm-hmm.
The more confidence they have that all this money will keep coming in, the higher the multiple, right?
Gone.
So the best, subscription-based models.
Yeah.
I mean, you've probably noticed over the last 5 years, every software you've ever used in your entire life suddenly turned into a subscription-based model.
Right? Yeah.
Right? So that's the IT is always the ahead of the game, right? So if you have recurring monthly revenue, your clients coming back, service contracts, right, that make up a large portion of your revenue, where your clients have been with you for 10 years, absolutely. Huh?
Yeah.
4 to 6 sounds pretty hefty. That also depends, again, what is the owner's role? What are your employees? What are you doing, right? So mm-hmm. when I say 2 to 3, I'm thinking about businesses that make between $400,000 and $500,000 in EBITDA. That means bottom line numbers a year, and then whatever the owner takes out, we add that back. And then the owner is involved in some kind of either management role, strategic role or something. And
yeah.
Small typical businesses that we see a lot in the United States, majority of businesses in the United States. When we go into businesses that have $1 million, $1.5 million EBITDA, we're looking at higher numbers, right? Mm-hmm. But 4 to 6, what do you say? 6 to 7?
4 to 6%, or four to six X.
4 to 6X on the multiple. If you have subscription-based recurring revenue and a solid, and again, you're in that $1 million range, sounds about right.
So, and for our listeners, this is an interesting topic because, like, for several years, I was against contracts and agreements. But as I, if I can digress a little bit and share a story, like during COVID, I was doing an M&A strategy with a consultant. We were looking for other agencies because at that time, like agencies were going under or people were starting agencies. And so part of our growth strategy, start to look for other agencies that were smaller in size or comparable. Let's see if we can merge or acquire with them. Got pretty far down the pipeline with that, but I got to take the position of a buyer and really find out like what was valuable. And to bring this full circle, like I found out how important it was to have contracts, because those were some of the questions. Like, what happens if I buy the business today and all your clients decide to leave tomorrow? And that was a real fear as a buyer. So I had to come back to my company and basically make a decision on like, look, we got to have agreements. As much as like I hate them, we have to, because that is the business. And it's predictable recurring income. And so for any of the listeners who have a service-based business or even a product, like get creative and think about the subscription side, because it was extremely an eye-opening moment for me when I was going through that.
Yeah, there's a rule of thumb that if you think you can't do it in your business, think again.
Yeah.
There's always a way. It's not easy. It's not easy. And a lot of people, it's very difficult, and you worry about losing some clients along the way. But in the long run, yeah, it's the better model.
Yeah. And for a long time, my value proposition was that we didn't do agreements and or contracts. I call them agreements because... Yeah.
It's a two-sided sword, right? You also don't want to have your client think they're tied to you and they can never leave. But then if you give them a way out, how valuable is the contract? Is it more of a psychological contract, which can be good enough as well, right?
Yeah.
In that context, when you sell a business, so you are a corporate entity. What's your corporate entity?
S-Corp.
Yeah, but where's the Design Loud LLC?
Design Loud Incorporated.
Design Loud Inc., right? So you own 100% of Design Loud Inc.
Correct.
Right? So normally, most businesses are purchased in what's called an asset purchase. Asset purchase. That means the buyer would incorporate their own legal entity.
Mm-hmm.
So Design Loud 2.0.inc or something, right? And then we contractually transfer everything that you own in that company over to them. So your customers, your staff, blah, blah, blah. Everything is contractually. Now they own all that. But you still have that ink. Now, if your contracts are with your legal entity, then the buyer would have to renew those contracts or novate them, right? Say, hey client, there's a new owner now. Design Loud 2.0, please sign a new contract with us. Which defeats the purpose to have contracts in place to make it easier for the transition.
Yeah.
Right? So how you circumvent that is, for instance, by doing a DBA. If you have Design Loud Inc., DBA, best marketing in the world, and your client signed with best marketing in the world, then you can close that DBA and the buyer can attach that DBA and all the contracts are still valid.
Interesting.
Right? Have a lawyer review that, right? I'm not putting my hand in the fire. But the problem is a lot of times contracts are in place. The other way of transferring a business is called a stock purchase.
Right.
That means you own 100% and then the buyer purchases the stock in your corporation. You no longer own the corporation. They own the corporation. Everything that stays underneath makes the operational transfer much easier because all your employee contracts and your like subscriptions to software and your cleaning service and all that just stays as is. They take over your bank accounts and so forth.
Yeah. Right?
But every attorney will caution a buyer to do a stock purchase because imagine you did something, and again, you're a marketing agency, but who knows, right? Something happened a year ago and suddenly that blows up and that client, whoever was injured by whatever that happened, but that was verbally or something or a physical, right? They're going to come after who? The Sound Loud Inc. Now the buyer owns it. He had nothing to do with that a year ago. Right?
Yeah.
So then the legal framework is a little bit more, much thicker. But I mean, there will be some recourse that if something happens prior to closing, he can still come after you. You're sitting on the island down where we are, Trinidad, Tobago, sipping on martinis. He can find you, right?
Yeah.
So despite the fact that the legal contract might protect him, a stock sale is much higher risk for buyer. That's why attorneys always caution buyers to do that. So that's always a little bit of a give and take.
Yes. And so also during COVID, my wife and I purchased a retail store down in the Cotton Exchange. Apparently during COVID, I had like an itch. So we got to satisfy that itch.
Busy.
Yeah. We had to satisfy that itch. We bought a retail store, and it was an asset purchase. And so we had to do the new LLC, keeping it somewhat similar, and then the DBA to keep the name and everything, mm-hmm. the signage all the same. But those were the exact conversations that we were having, is like, why do we want to do that separate LLC and then do a DBA? Is because like we just wanted a clean split from any potential things that may have been there that we weren't aware of. We didn't want it to come back and bite us.
That's fact. We're talking about
What are the most common mistakes business owners make when trying to sell their business?
Most business owners, especially if they have an attractive industry or attractive size, right, get emails and all the time, I want to buy a business, right? And they don't care about it until maybe it itches them and they go like, well, why not, right? And they go, they think that person's going to buy the business.
Yeah.
But there's been no numbers have been, that person who's emailed that has no clue about how much money they're making, right?
Yeah.
They've not seen anything. They're sending out this letter looking for somebody in that industry. There have been no conversations. And then let's say you call them back and you say, sure, I'm open to talk, right? Mm-hmm. And then you send them over your financials, your tax returns, and they come back with a number. I didn't know it's a good number.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, I had somebody recently told me they sold their business, a roofing business, and it was a good number. How do you know? Yeah. You didn't talk to me before. You sold it to whoever knocked on your door, right? The next thing is, I already mentioned it earlier, is that you get fatigue in the process. And that fatigue means that your business is dropping, right?
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily because the seller is the key person to make the money, but if a business owner, and I'm sure you could kind of like relate to that, is if you just not into it anymore, is your staff going to feel that?
Yeah.
And it's just going to maybe slack a little bit more, or sales going to drop off, and you know what I mean?
Yep, exactly.
So that's that fatigue before you actually make that pull. Again, we talked about what a big step it is and how important and how emotionally, financially important it is for a seller, right? But think about all that before you get tired of what you're doing, because I had a client. I could have sold the business 3-4 years ago for, let's say, $750,000.
Mm-hmm.
We just got rid of it for $100,000.
Oh, that's going to hurt.
The only reason they had some health issues, and they brought the daughter in and the son-in-law to take over husband and wife's role, and they just played owner. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So they didn't do anything. They just didn't want to do the role, take over the role exactly how the parents had done it. And there was also maybe some economic impact, but business declined. And they destroyed a bunch of value.
Right? Yeah.
So that fatigue and that making the wrong move is just, when you sell a business, you're coordinating three things. Is it the right time in the market? Is it the right time for my business? Is it the right time for me personally? Right.
Right.
Is it the right time for the market? We have absolutely no influence, right? We can only watch what's going on. So right now, interest rates are high. That's pretty much the only negative impact. But in reality, over the last years, and as far as we can look back, it's always been a sales market because there's just never enough inventory. I talk to an average of 50 buyers, right?
Yeah.
A lot of them will never buy a business, right? But there's a significant higher number of people looking to buy it than sellers, right? That means if you have a good business and you have a good asking price, you can sell it very fast because there's a lot of people out there. So is this a good time for the market? I would say yes, 100%. Is it the right time for my business? Well, that's what we look at when we do the business valuations and have the conversation with the sellers, like what's good, what's bad, the good, the bad, and the ugly. What can you change? How fast would it take you to change that, right? What can you still roll back from the past? Like sometimes business owners write off a lot of their personal stuff and just don't do that in 2024, right?
Yeah.
Oh, you haven't filed your 23 taxes. Let's just not do that in 23. Let's show what's actually the business operation expenses.
Yeah.
Right? So again, what can you fix in the business? Can you take yourself? Can you rehire a person? Can you pull yourself out more of the operation? Can you make one of your key team members get that license as well that you have and things like this? So what are the things you do? Is it the right time for your business? Is it what's the track record? That's what we talk about, right? Mm-hmm. So let's say we say yes. So market, business, is it the right time for you personally? Well, I don't know. Yeah. It's the only one that is 100% in the control of that seller, but it's the hardest one to trigger. Understand?
Yeah.
So you should, if you own a business, you should go put yourself a goal out there, saying, I want to sell my business for $3 million. But let's think about, where do I need to be? Where do I need to be with my business in order to sell it for $3 million? Okay, we can have a conversation. These are the numbers. This is where you are now. This is what you have to do. This is where you have to get to. And then work on that to get to the $3 million and then sell it. And don't hang on to it and then something happens. And, oh, my God, of course, a lot of times the sea strikes when you need it the least.
Right.
And then I have So that's the way you should do it. But, again, it's the emotional attachment and, of course, the financial dependency that people have that makes it very hard.
Yeah.
So the best advice to you is make that kind of plan and sell it young enough. You still have the energy to go after the next great thing.
I feel like the ugly duckling because I hear of these emails that people get, like, hey, I want to buy your business. I'm like, bro, where am I even? Why did anybody email at me? Like, come on. But when I was going through that M&A phase, somebody who is much more like financial minded than I was kind of relying on told me something that kind of stuck with me. And it's like, people will tell you one reason why they're selling, but you need to find out like what the real reason is. And so sometimes the profit and loss can tell you that. Like, are they selling because there was a family emergency or a health thing, right? And as bad as it sounds, that's potentially a leverage that you have in the buying of that business.
Like, negotiation.
It gives you a little bit of an understanding of how motivated they are to sell it quickly. But there's also something that I heard, I have no personal experience with this, but like sometimes these emails that come in if somebody wants to buy your business, they'll give you an outrageous price. And then like right at the last minute, they're like, this is the final offer, you know, and you're already so far in the due diligence and everything where, you know, I would imagine a lot of people kind of cave, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's this carrot stick or this bait and switch where it's like, here's the bait. Yeah. And so I hear those situations too. So it's something that I've kind of kept top of mind that I wanted to bring up here if it's a value.
So two things you talked about now. So let's address the first one, the true motive of the sale. When I deal with my clients, which are always the sellers, I need to understand what's going on.
Yeah.
So if you're not honest with me, I'm sorry, I'm not taking you on as a client.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because it's a big process. It's a huge thing. And I work... I'm in the business to sell businesses, so I want to make sure I understand everything, all the intricacies, and also I want to know what's happening during the process, right? It's things are getting worse, better, so forth, right? So, it could be that somebody says, I want to retire, but they actually have some health issues, right? In reality, like, you said, the buyer can use it to the advantage in the negotiation. Again, if you come across a seller that doesn't have somebody like me on their side, probably. If you have somebody like me on the side, I do what's called the accusation audit.
Mm-hmm.
Means in the very first conversation with a potential buyer, I tell them all the terrible stuff about that business. Mm-hmm. Why am I doing that? Because if that buyer is still interested after they hear all the terrible stuff, and if we go down the road, they're not going to find anything terrible because I already told them.
Right? I think that's super important. Yes.
It's like so amazing. It works so well. So is there some hidden motive? Can you use it for your negotiation? Probably, but in reality, like you said, the numbers is what matters, right? It doesn't matter whether that guy sells because he just doesn't want to sell carpets anymore or whether that guy sells because he wants to move to Connecticut or whether he sells because he just is tired and wants to go play golf every day, right?
Right.
If the numbers are great and you think you're going to be able to take this over and it all gives you the impression that you kind of, and all your due diligence answers, yes, 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 this is going to work out for you. The numbers make sense. You get that loan. Does it matter why?
Yeah, it does. But if you don't disclose that, you plant that seed of doubt. And then that seed of doubt follows you through the process. And you're like, what else could there be that I don't know?
The seed of doubt, the seed of doubt is what I said, the accusation, Alan. Mm-hmm. The seed of doubt is extremely important, especially once you get to the point of a letter of intent. So you get like, maybe that's in conjunction with that second question about they sell a number, they say they're going to buy for a number, but then it's the actual offer and whatnot, right? Is when you sign the letter of intent with a buyer, a letter of intent is a non-binding agreement that sets the intentions of the parties to close the deal under the agreed terms, right? But you pretty much want to take it from there to closing, right? You don't want to say, oh, we sent a letter of intent, let's see where it goes, and we can still talk about all kinds of things. It's silly. It's just such a waste of time. Spend the time first. Give some more information. Make sure you discuss all the terms and how long do you want me to stay on and how fast can we close and what else are you waiting for and what are the key things that you're worried about and things like that. Have this, right? Mm-hmm. Have this all discussed before you sign a letter of intent. And then you go through due diligence and you get to closing. So if anything happens in that phase, it's just, I found that piece of paper, you didn't show that to me. Mm-hmm. It's just that piece of paper. It's really not important. What else did you
do? Yes, exactly. Right? Exactly.
So you got to be really, really careful. So that's why we prepare everything beforehand. And then the thing about that's the offer, that's the actual number. Yeah, of course. I mean, you always got to be very diligent of what you're signing and what you're going for, right? Mm-hmm. And very rarely are people contacted with a number. They're usually just saying, oh, we want to buy your business. If you get a number, how did they come up with that number? Because they've never seen your financials, so it's completely a fluke. You can assume that. And then the other thing that I wanted to say is, a lot of times, unfortunately, like in every industry, and I'm sure you know it too, there's some black sheep, is people contact business owners and say, I have a buyer, I'm a broker, give me a business for sale, but you really don't have a buyer, or it's somebody new. That looks at everything but has never bought anything or something. So just don't fall for that.
Yeah, good advice. How can small business owners prepare for an eventual exit, even if they're years away from selling?
Very important is cost control. Like, don't let things slide. Always go back and say, what am I spending? What I'm spending it on? Is there a better way, right? Mm-hmm. Again, this very attractive thing of writing off personal expenses through the business. Again, we're talking about the gray area of legality. And it's like this. For every dollar you show on the bottom line of your business, you might get, let's say, $3 when you sell the business. For every dollar you do not show on the bottom line on your tax return, you might save yourself how much? 30 cents? Let's say 30 cents. Okay, so now you've not shown a dollar, so you saved yourself 30 cents in taxes. Now you sell the business, you could have gotten $3 for that dollar.
Yeah.
So if you do that more than 10 years, you win. But don't be disappointed that you sell your business for much less money than you thought.
Yeah.
If you show everything on your tax return and you get that $3, you sold your business for that. So clean books and records is the topic. Keep your books and records clean. Don't mingle businesses. If you start a whole new business line, just incorporate, run your own taxes, because it will be very hard to filter it out, right? Yeah. If you have a new business, look, obviously, if it's just another subsidiary in a different town, then they all feed into each other, and you would want to sell that and exit out of the whole lot, then it makes sense. But if you have something completely separate, don't intermingle. Keep your books and records clean. Don't pay people stuff that they shouldn't get. Write everything through the business, categorize it right, make sure your accounting is clean, right? Because way down the line, we got to go back 3 years, and then why is this number so high in this category? And what was office supplies? We have, for instance, when I talked about the seller's discretionary earning, of course, what we also can add back is if you have a one-time expense. Let's say 1 year, you renovate your office and you have everything painted and buy a bunch of new tables. That should be on the balance sheet, could also be on the profit. Mm-hmm. Let's say it was a $15,000 investment, right? So have that separate so we can say, okay, in this year you spent $15,000, but you're not spending $15,000 every year. So we can add that back, that increases your bottom line, that increases your value.
You tell.
Clean books and records. And then the next thing is, what is my role as an owner, right? We talked earlier about, am I the key person, or is the business only running because I'm here, I'm working 60 hours in the week in the factory or in the shop? Or is it I got my people doing the work, I got the people in the office, I make sure everybody knows what they're doing, I make strategic decisions, right?
Yeah.
That, of course, is more valuable. So over time, of course, when you start a business, it's hard and you got to work 10 hours, 15 hours a day and everything is just tumultuous. And over time, control your costs, keep your books and records clean, make sure you're not an important key factor because you're going to have to be replaced when you sell into those pretty important things. And then, of course, we're talking about where does your customers come from, the customer pipeline. That's very important. We talked about that earlier.
There are some interesting things that come front of mind for me on that. First, I need like elementary, think of like your letter blocks. And so I've always heard, or I've always, I guess, lived by, there's the business that you run for the government, which you want to write off every single thing you can. There's the business you want to run for the selling, right? And I guess to tie it in, it's like the 30 cents versus the $3. Yeah. What happened, I'd like to talk about with that M&A. Like I said, we got pretty far along the process with a few. One particular sticks out because the owner was the business. And it's like, okay, we came up with some creative ways to address that. There also, there were technically no employees. They were contractors. So there were no, agreements or anything. It's like really what we were buying at that time was revenue. And so ultimately why that specific deal fell through was because we saw that as soon as the owner left, we would have to have an employer, somebody we'd have to hire to put in. And we were also offering, what's it called? You buy the business, but you're basically like making payments to the owner.
Seller financing.
Thank you. Seller financing. So we were trying to offer seller financing because of the amount of risk that was involved in buying that business. And that's ultimately where it fell through. But one quick thing I wanted to...
Let me address this for a second.
Sure.
I mean, you are aware that seller financing still has you obligated to pay.
Absolutely.
Right? So a different thing would be if you want to make it dependent on the continued success of the business, then you do an earnout that's tied to either revenue or net profit of the business.
Right.
Right. So a seller financing is an obligation. I'm just saying X amount of dollars have to be paid over a certain length of time, but you have to pay whether you are successful or you fail.
Right.
Obviously, I'm representing sellers. I never accept earnout propositions. So
maybe what you were offered was the earnout because the owner was looking to get out of it to work full time in another business. So it seemed like they were trying to get out of it almost immediately. And there was very little transition time where they would stay on.
So coming again from a seller's perspective, you don't want to be that person that is that key person.
Yeah.
Whether you have W-2 or 1099 employees, in my opinion, doesn't make a big difference depending on how much these 1099 work for you. Of course, from a legal perspective, there is a rule and it cannot work specifically for you or something like this. But a lot of times people like have installers and they hire these installers all the time and these installers show up whenever you need them and they're 1099, right? But you have those installers and you're going to continue to use them. They would be considered in that context as if they were employees because they're always available for legal. Mm-hmm.
Would you want agreements with them, though? Because technically, just like the risk with buying a business from clients with no agreement in place, couldn't the contractors technically walk like the day
they have the business? Why would they? So now they've been working for, let's say it's a landscaping installation company, and every time you need a backflow, you hire, we call this guy.
Yeah.
So now this guy's been making an average of $40,000 a year from you by you sending him to these job sites. Now somebody else buys the company. Why would you not want to continue to make those $40,000? I mean, it's not like you're going to go turn around and find the $40,000 somewhere else.
Yeah.
If I'm the brother and I'm actually making a good deal that's a different situation.
Maybe the contractor doesn't like the new boss or something.
Well, okay. So that's what I tell every buyer is that comes with a concern like this. If you take over a business, right, number one rule is you have to listen to the seller. You have to listen to them, how they do it and what they do. And you have to watch how that this makes them successful. If over time, I'm talking 2-3 months, you try to continue to do the same thing, you realize there is a better way, then you change it. But you don't come in and immediately change it.
Yeah.
And if you come in as a buyer and you are a big bear, the people gotta walk away.
Yeah. Right?
If you're not nice, if you don't treat humans like humans should be treated, right?
Yeah. And that's also, I think, a big risk with people wanting to sell their business is like knowing who they're selling to and are the people that are with them, like, they going to retain the culture? Are they going to treat people fairly? Is there room for growth and promotion?
And that's definitely a very tricky part of the sale. Buyers often want to meet the staff before they make an offer. I never allow that. Because from a seller's perspective, you want to come in and buy my business and you want to meet my five people that work for me. So you got to meet and you talk to them. But then you say, no, I'm not going to make an offer. The next guy comes, he wants to meet everybody. The next guy comes.
Yeah.
Or then you make an offer and say, oh yeah, the guy made an offer. And then during due diligence, I don't know, something happens with you in your personal life and you still walk away. And like, oh, the guy made it. So now the staff goes like, oh, what's going to happen? I didn't like the first guy. I like the third guy. What's happening with the second guy, right? They can handle that. So I was like, I can handle that up and down and maybe you, maybe not, maybe somebody else. I can handle that. And that's my job. The seller has to handle it because that's just part of selling the business.
Yeah.
You cannot put that pressure on or that stress on employees. So no meeting with employees before closing. Can they meet maybe the key management? Yes. During due diligence. So between letter of intent, we go through due diligence. I maybe let them meet up at the very end. If everything else is checked, then the lender has already, the underwriter has given the commitment letter and whatnot. But then also we don't have to come in and say, hey, this Jack is going to buy my business. Talk to him.
Yeah.
You're like, Jack, we're looking to bring Jack in as the new sales guy, the general manager, supporting us with the whatever, right? Go meet Jack. Let's have a conversation. He just wanted to talk to somebody who works in a company, right? And then you get a feedback from both, right? But that is very tricky. But then from the buyer's perspective, of course, you go like, what if I come in and all these people not going to show up for work? But in reality, people show up for work because they have the job, right?
Yeah.
And as you know, from management books that you've read and experienced as an owner, people never leave a job. They leave a manager.
That's right. That's actually really good advice. So I had met with some of the key, and they were key members. So they were all employees. That one particular case where the deal fell through, but it was further in due diligence. And the reason we met with a few of the key members was, A, to make sure they were still on board with this and just get familiar. It seemed like a really good match. Everything seemed great. But there was also one or two that we were interested in making sure that they could be the presence and kind of take over the owner's role of being that social person because we needed that local sale. So we had to meet with them and kind of get an idea of what their vision was for their career path within the company. And that was extremely valuable to me as a buyer. But to your point, like if there were many buyers, potential buyers on the table, like I can see where that, as an employer, I can see where that could be resource hog, you know, time consuming.
That's not that. It's difficult. And then your employees might start running away because you know, like he's selling the company.
Yeah.
I met the first guy, he was a real.
Yeah.
But I'm going to go. I'm looking for a new job. You don't want that.
No, at all. Let's see. So we've answered some of these. I'm trying to. Okay, so this is a good one. So especially coming from me and like there was no formal training to entrepreneurship, business ownership. Like I had to read a lot and truth be told, I barely know how to read. But what are some of the different potential exits that business owners have? Because it's not just buying and selling, right?
Right.
That's the question.
The question is, what are the potential exits that a business owner has?
When you own a business and now how do you get out? Well, you can hand it over to your employees, ESOPs, right?
Gone.
Employee stock option. You can bring somebody in to run it for you and you just take the money. Like it's, again, number, you make $500,000 bottom line. Now you bring in a general manager, pay him $250,000. You still make $250,000 a year and the business keeps on running. But if the manager doesn't work out, then maybe you still might have to be involved.
What's the difference for people who may not be aware and it's late in the episode for this, but what's the difference between a merger and an acquisition?
Merger is two companies,
becoming one.
Right. Is that generally under like a 50-50 partnership?
It's actually becoming something new, or one is more the dominant and sucks the other one in.
Okay.
Right? An acquisition. Yeah, it's blending. Once somebody buys something, and it's about who's the ownership and who. It's like more public companies when they merge. But mergers is more a merger of equals, and an acquisition is somebody dissolved the other one.
Okay.
There. But then again, often companies buy little companies but maintain that corporate identity of the little company towards the clients, right? You don't even know.
Okay.
It's completely insignificant, the borderline where it is.
Well, and so there was a strategy. This may appeal to you. I don't know how. You could tell me I'm completely off topic here. There was a strategy that I kind of modified and adopted, and it kind of became like my personal vision as a business owner, where, let's say, for anybody who's listening who wants to steal it, go right ahead. At least like give me credit or anything, or unless it's a bad idea. I've got a parent entity. Under this parent entity, through an M&A strategy, I've got different agencies that really focus on different things. Like, we're really good and focused on digital marketing, right? We don't so much focus on photography, videography. So having a creative agency, having a content writing agency, a graphic design agency, et cetera, we all become part of this parent entity. And my vision with that was that the parent entity buys 70% of these agencies. The original owner maintains 30% control in those agencies, but then has a percentage of ownership in this parent entity. And then through that, we just kind of multiply. Like, as a digital marketing agency, we would look for other digital marketing agencies. So it becomes more or less like this pyramid, where ultimately, like, we just all of a sudden have a whole lot of market share. We've got a big, thriving portfolio of companies. And it's not just one person. It's like a collective of board members.
So that's very common. It's called a roll-up.
Okay.
And a large time private equity firms do that. So what they would do, they would buy, like you said, either companies in adjacent industries, or that perhaps service a similar customer base into a similar space, or they would buy very comparable businesses in different markets, like, I don't know, the furniture stores in 5 different towns or something. Mm-hmm. It's a roll-up, and they pull it together because, as I mentioned earlier, the higher your EBITDA, the higher your multiples.
Yeah.
So if you buy 5 companies and they all do $1 million in EBITDA, suddenly you make $5 million in EBITDA, and that attracts a whole different buyer, and that even could be attractive to a public company to suck that up. Right?
Yeah, that's always kind of been attractive to me, and it seemed like a quick way to grow. And I've known of somebody who's done something similar, and they have been in business for less years than me, and have like surpassed with employee count, revenue count, because they did something similar. So let it
it's again, how do you finance that? Where does that money come from? Because when you buy 80%, you have to find, of course, the right target company. But now if you want to buy 70-80% of that company, you have to finance that, right?
Yeah.
How do you finance that, right? So once you get rolling, then you make money from your original. And again, I wouldn't have the original one up here. Would you have the original one down here? They're all next to each other. You have a holding company over it. That's what you usually do, right? So then the money that you make here, the money that you can make here, you can leverage to purchase the next one.
Okay. And that is generally like where leveraging or having a relationship with the broker would be extremely valuable, right? Because you could find these businesses as well and then help handle that ins and outs.
When I say leverage, I'm talking about financing, banks, right? You go to the bank, you say, hey, I have 2 businesses. They both make $200,000 a year. So I'm making $400,000 a year. I want to borrow $300,000 a year. I can service a loan to buy something for $1 million because of the $300,000. And that business, again, makes me $200,000 and I can get another loan. So in the end of the, you have a big portfolio.
Yeah.
But also a lot of stress.
Yeah. If I'm going to take that on, it needs to happen this late in my life.
Yeah.
What's a memorable success story from a sale you've worked on, and what can the audience learn from it?
Every's not a really good one. But that's more out of the secret treasure chest of Regina Fisher, negotiator.
Okay.
So I had a business that was worth about $2.3 million. And he had $1 million in inventory. So now Business valuations are not rocket science.
Moved.
And the majority of business valuations and valuators always look at a business. Again, we're looking at that bottom number or multiply and all that, like I said earlier, but they look at, well, it's included the inventory, right? That makes total sense for me if, let's say, it's a restaurant, right? Yeah. And you make $700,000 in EBITDA and you have $30,000 in fish and steaks in your cooler, right? Because you need the fish and steaks today to cook them or something, whatever.
Yeah.
It does not make sense for me if I'm a business that's worth 2.3 and has got $1 million in inventory because it gets the stuff from Taiwan and it takes sometimes 6 months, and we still had a bunch of crises. We had COVID, we had the canal, during disaster, the Suez Canal, and who knows what. So he just has all this stuff on stock because he ships to his clients same day. So it doesn't make any sense to include that. And we found a buyer that loved it, went through the whole motions, negotiated. I started off with my clients saying, I'm not doing any seller financing. And everybody's saying, oh, I could offer you $2 million for the business, including the inventory. Like, that's a big gap, right? That's, yeah, that's a gap of $1 million, which is 50%. Long story short, that guy who loved it made an offer. I talked my client into financing that $1 million inventory over the course of a year. Now we're getting towards letter of intent, we're going through the diligence, now the guy deals with his bank. And a lot of times I want the buyer to connect me directly to his lender, because when they have questions, I can give them all the answers directly. In this particular case, he said, no, I have the relationship and I deal with them. And I mean, obviously I don't step in between, I kind of like supported them. But anyway, I have no clue what the bank did in the background. It's been dragging out. It's 10 days now, we're supposed to finally close in 10 days. And I get this phone call and he says, I got the valuation from the bank and it says 2.1 million.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But I just realized that's including the inventory. Why am I paying an extra million?
Yeah.
And he actually, even because he was going to finance it over a year, the guy offered an additional 10%. So again, 2.1 million, a million, 10, right? So I was on this phone call with this guy for a long time. I remember, because that is when the stress level, you can't imagine, like, okay, this is falling apart right now, right in front of my eyes. What am I going to do? So I went outside and I was picking weeds out of my... herb garden, because you need to call me.
Yeah.
I was doing something on the side, staying just completely calm. And I told him, I said a lot of things, but the gist of it was, look, number one, I said, doesn't make any sense, because if he didn't have any inventory in stock right now, yeah, with a business that'd be only worth $1 million, but he makes $500,000-$600,000 in EBITDA. No, that makes no sense, right? Yeah. So that inventory has to be in top, but it's a big number, right? And then I said, look, you know what you can do with this business.
Yes.
Anyway, we closed the deal. We closed the deal, and I don't know how the business is running. My client had an agreement with him to help him for a certain length of time, and then afterwards they would have to pay him. So after this, they have to pay him. They haven't called him yet. They haven't called me yet. Everything is good. My client recently came down. He flies small airplanes, and he invited me on a little flight around Southport. So he's super happy, retired in his 60s, got a lot of money, still has to wait now for a year to get that inventory paid off. But it's on paper, it's signed, promissory note, personal guarantee, and everything attached to it.
Nice.
That'd be close. But that was one for the books for sure.
Congratulations. So back to the original point we were talking about at the beginning, you are kind of a therapist during those situations.
Yeah, no. I'm a therapist for my clients, but I am definitely a negotiator, and that's part of my absolutely favorite things to do.
Yes. Yeah.
And it's very much, I also came, if I could talk about myself for a second.
Please.
At some point, I came to the realization is that the key factor that I don't appreciate so much about my current job is that I'm not making decisions. I don't make a decision to sell, to buy, to make an offer, accept an offer. I'm just not making any of these big decisions.
Mm-hmm.
But then thinking further about it, I'm actually making micro decisions all day long. And micro decisions mean, how am I sending this over right now? Am I going to say it like this? Am I going to send it? I'm going to call. Is it better for a call? Should I set up this call with these people now? Because a lot of times it's my job is from the very first moment I have a conversation with a potential buyer. And again, I talk to 50, but only one's going to buy.
Right? Yeah.
But you never know who it is.
It's exhausting.
Yeah.
From the very first conversation I have with a potential buyer all the way until closing, that buyer has to go, yep, this is good, this is better, more optimism, yeah, this is going to work out for me. And then if something happens, we talked about the seed of doubt earlier, I have to make sure it doesn't go where, and it goes, yeah, and it keeps going. But I just have, I have to build it up. So everything I said, it's not about hiding facts or not telling the truth about, it's always a question of how you present it. And it's always a question about, sometimes it's a question of how fast you answer, right?
Yeah.
And fast meaning, sometimes it can be, this is, I am going to answer this right now so you can continue to work, because a lot of my work is driving progress. But a lot of times when you get into a situation, it's like, well, we just wait 24 hours.
Yeah.
And in 24 hours, a lot of things happen and a lot of questions get dissolved and concerns get dissolved. So either, so it's, I'm making hundreds and hundreds of micro decisions on a daily basis throughout that process in order to drive it. And again, it's not about lying. It's not about deceiving. It's all about making sure that the buyer feels it's all. It's so psychological. It's so emotional.
Yeah, I love the psychology element.
Yeah. It's all about, again, feeling good about the decision you're making, right?
Mm-hmm.
Being able to go and tell your friends, buy this business, and everybody says, "Wow, it's a great idea."
Yeah.
And you got to feel good about that. So again, the numbers don't lie, right? The due diligence doesn't lie, right? You get access to books and records and everything, but how you feel about that whole process. And I get a lot of positive feedback, both from my clients and buyers that I talk to about that process, how we deal with that.
Yeah, I can imagine it's very rewarding when you get to the finish line on those for you and the client.
But you know what the funny part is?
What?
My deals take on average 9 months. So I have relationships with clients. Sometimes they come to me and they're just not ready to sell. Like I said earlier, you have a certain number in mind and we got to work through that. That client I mentioned with that inventory, first time I talked to them, I think it was end of 2020. And we finally put it on the market in end of 23 and sold it in May of 24. So I've known this guy for 3.5, 4 years, right?
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of times I know these people for 2, 3, 4 years, 10 months, 5 months. But when it's all said and done, and it's intense. At the end, there's 15 text messages and phone calls and emails every day and questions and what this and suddenly and whatnot, right? And nervous and blotches or whatever the promise they have, right? But it was all said to them, they didn't get me.
They're like, bye.
How is they? Tell me what they're doing.
Yeah.
Very rarely get a picture from somebody now around the lake or something, right? I mean, they don't remember, but it's very funny how that's become such an intense relationship and then just drops off.
It's almost like working with a realtor to buy a house, I imagine, which was the most stressful thing of my life, buying a house. And it's like, as soon as it was done, it was like, I don't want to ever relive that process again.
Yeah, but houses sell much faster than businesses. Like I said, the average is 9 months.
Yeah, that's a long time. And I remember from my experience, it took, the retail store was a little faster because the seller was motivated to sell.
Mm-hmm.
But the other one just seemed like it was taking forever. And to your earlier point, like, it's a dance knowing, do I reply now so that I don't hold up progress and momentum? Or is this something that needs to sit with the recipient for a while to settle and then come back 24?
Yeah, I mean, for instance, I was waiting here earlier, right? I got this email from a business under contract, and the buyer keeps sending me these questions. And, yeah, there's the answer. Ask my seller, answer. He sends me another one. I'm like, now I got to educate him.
Yeah.
I got to tell him, say, look, you got to send me a list of 10 questions.
Yes.
But that can also go in the wrong direction, right? And I don't know this also. Some questions are coming from his lender, and we do need to send him a good answer quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Some questions, it's just him being super ego, already thinking about taking over and transitioning and everything else, right? So then you go like, stop that. We're not trading you yet. What do you need for the bank, right? So that's just an example of what that process looks like. And if, I mean, you can make many mistakes and you might still be successful, but I'm a big believer you're trying really, really hard to make all the decisions the right way and make it well, so increase the likelihood of success.
Why do you believe it's important for somebody, even if they have no intention of selling, like that may change down the road. Why is it important for business owners to know and to operate in this way so that they could later sell if they decide to? But even if they don't decide to, like, why is it a healthy...
Yeah, because none of the things that are going to make your business easier to sell or more valuable when you sell in the end is actually a bad idea. You know what I mean?
Agreed.
Having your books and records clean is a good idea because then where you actually know how much does it cost me to operate my business, mm-hmm. right? If you fumble in all kinds of stuff, you'll never know, right? To have a smart funnel marketing system in place that funnels customers into your pipeline so you have an even stream of customers is not a bad idea, right?
Yep.
To make sure you're not the key person and if you're not there, nothing happens, is also not a bad idea because guess what? You might break your leg or you might want to go on a honeymoon or do something else, right? Yeah. Go on a camping trip for 3 days and you want to be able to do that and you might need that life work balance yourself, right?
Yeah.
So none of the things that make your business more valuable are a bad idea, right?
Yeah, agree. Test this theory because somebody told me if you can disappear for a month and your business continues to function and operate, then you're in a pretty good position where it doesn't rely on you exclusively to operate.
A month is a very good one, yeah.
There's also, I like to share any kind of tidbits of information, AI prompts. There's one that I ran recently that I thought is valuable here. I took my profit and loss over the last year, loaded it up into ChatGPT, and I gave it the prompt, you know, you're a financial expert. I want you to analyze this profit and loss statement for the digital marketing agency and let me know what categories I'm underspending and what categories I'm overspending. And then let me know what the average category percentage should be. And I was blown away to see like certain categories where I'm basically underspending. Like I need to be spending more money based on averages.
And is that benchmarking you against other agencies?
Yes. Benchmarking, but it's also kind of taking my P&L. And I did this for a few years too. So I did it at first through 2024. And then I uploaded all 3 year P&Ls. And I was like, let me know where we're growing, where we're struggling, like basically give me an idea. It was pretty eye-opening to see that and what ChatGPT kind of came out with.
Okay.
So just a little tip.
All right. So that's a very, very good topic. One of my favorite topics actually after negotiation is metrics mm-hmm. and information like this.
Yeah.
A lot of people get so hung up on collecting KPIs, metrics, understanding, doing stuff like this, analyzing things, right?
Yeah.
I say none of that has any value unless it triggers an action.
Yeah, exactly.
I had a buddy recently tell me he did the math how much his kids cost him. Now they're both in college.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, all right, it cost me $1 million, whatever. I said, okay, so kids are expensive. We know that. But what are you going to do with this information now?
Yeah.
There's nothing you're going to do with it. It's just like you can tell people over dinner party. Yeah, that's great, right? Huh. So as a business owner, right, if you measure success, if you measure your churn rate of your customers, your tenure of your employees, if you measure the average ticket price or something, that is good to know, right? But good to know is not good enough. When you measure something, then you need to look at it and say, okay, now I have this information. What now? If my average customer brings in $3,000, is that good enough for me? Do I want to increase that? If I have a customer concentration, like is an extremely important thing I haven't brought up yet. Customer concentration means, is there a few customers that make up a large percentage of your revenue? Let's say the top customer brings in 35% of your revenue, the next one 25%, so that's already 60%,
mm-hmm.
and then another one 10%. So the top three customers bring in 70% of your revenue. If one or two of these leave you, there goes your business, right? Yeah. But yes, you do that, look at that, but what's the action that's going to be triggered?
Yeah.
Right? So that's the key thing. Don't just look at information and data and metrics.
For the curiosity of it.
Yeah. I'm curious what it's going to be
like. Exactly. Right?
But if you want to improve things, you're always going to have an action trigger.
And for anybody who is at the point where you look at your client, you realize that a client makes up a majority of your revenue, there's a really good book for that. It's called Built to Sell. And basically, it's an agency owner. He's a graphic design agency. He realizes that his a banking client makes up like a significant amount of his revenue. He realizes that he needs to niche down into a specific service line. So he just starts doing logos instead of all these other things. He loses that client, but he makes up that revenue through new clients that he's got. And not one of them makes up a large percentage of his revenue, which was a genius, but it's a short read. But yeah, that's extremely valuable information.
The risk. But then again, if that client's been with you for 15 years and you're told it's a sticky product and you know they're not going to go anywhere, then keep them.
Yeah.
But have a trigger.
Yeah.
Have an action.
All right. So, Regina, thank you so much for being on the show. I've got one small outro request. This is something that I'm trying to do for everybody that I have on the show. And basically, I'd like you to give a shout out to an entrepreneur or business owner that you admire or who has inspired you in some way and why.
Oh, my God. Admire or inspired.
Mm-hmm.
Look, I get a lot of inspiration from all my clients, so that's a difficult one right now. And I also never talk about my clients, neither before, during, or after the process. It's just the general rule I have,
yeah.
So I cannot name any names, right?
Mm-hmm.
But, But I want to name a friend, if
sure.
That's okay.
Please.
He recently took over in Southport. That's here on the coast in North Carolina near Wilmington. In Southport, he took over a place called Gourmet To Go. It's a tiny little / takeout restaurant. They cook food. They put it in these little takeout containers. They cater a lot. It was his dream to own his own business. He's always worked for some kind of company in town. He had some back problems, was suffering for a long time, couldn't do his job anymore. And that triggered for him to go out and look for alternatives. And he came across that. And he just bought it a month and a half ago. And it's going really well. The seller's still working with him. He's got a great team in place. They do really healthy options. They have clients that only eat their food because they want to lose weight, or they lose weight if they eat the healthy options. I had an apple cake down there. It was amazing. And shout out to Gourmet To Go in Southport. Support my friend, Adam. He is the new business owner.
Perfect. Perfect. Thank you, Adam. You can't ask for a better testimony. Regina, thank you so much. Where can people find you online if they're interested in more information?
Bristol Group Online. Bristol, BRISTOL, grouponline.com. Or just Google Regina Fisher Business Broker. I think my face is going to pop up.
All right. Perfect. Well, thank you so much for being our guest. Hey, make sure you subscribe for more insights, and if you like this episode, consider sharing it with a friend. Join our free community at entrepreneurbootcamppodcast.com and let's start building a great business together.